hearing on
2491.
House Bill 2491. And we have the wonderful Representative Betsy Johnson here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The lady with the big glasses as described in the Oregonian.
Man, I have big glasses.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I am the state representative from House District 31. I have brought you this bill based on my 8 years of experience as a publicly elected port commissioner. I know the good work that ports do, and by nature, some of the rural ports draw from a pretty shallow pool of people willing and able to serve. These are some of the same folks who belong to Rotary together, who maybe live next to each other, and who frequently do business together. Given the economic development role that ports play, they often need to act behind closed doors in building business deals. This is not a bad thing. They also need to keep the elements of some of these deals confidential until the prospect has fully matured. So in order to protect the nimbleness of ports and yet reassure simultaneously the public that business is being conducted appropriately behind closed doors, I have offered a bill that would add ports, with the exception of the Port of Portland, to the list of public bodies that have to do financial disclosures. This has passed the House. There is no known opposition. I have consulted with Ken Armstrong from the Ports Group. He has been amazingly helpful and cooperative. The Port of Portland has no objection, and I commend it for your review.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions, Senator Starr? This is the Port Bill 2491, directing these folks to file statements of economic interest. No questions? Okay. Representative, as soon as we get a third vote in here, we'll move this puppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Close public session on 2491. Let's see if we can hear any other public sessions. We have the employment division here.
Yes.
I saw Tamara outside there.
Outside. We also have the 3068.
Is that you here for 3068, Mary?
I'm here for,
okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3068A. Would you tell us what that does, Mark, please?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 3068A is designed to prohibit a public body from disclosing a photograph of an employee, a member of the public body, without the employee's written consent.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with AFSCME, Council 75. This bill was introduced by Senator Patridge. Sorry, Mark. on our behalf, and we understand the attorney.
It says here is introduced by Representative Prochoisky.
What did I say?
Patridge.
It was a P name.
Okay, it was a P name. That's about
it. It would be Prozansky, the Democrat, as opposed to Patridge, the Republican. Yes, I do know the difference.
That's Abe Lincoln versus Perry Mason.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Ooh. That's not on my public record.
Yes.
Think about that for a second.
Yeah. Anyway, this bill was introduced because of those nice little ID badges that everybody has to wear now with their pictures. We have people who work at the Department of Justice for the Attorney General that have some concerns that some of the cases they handle are so volatile that if, for instance, the woman who asked us to introduce it handles death penalty cases and appeals, and she was concerned that inmates could actually get a copy of her ID badge and share it with family members where she could actually be stalked out of the building. And so that was a big issue. Now, here's the technical problem we have with the bill. This morning, the Attorney General's office said this bill's much too broad. This is what we have to do. We have amendments in Legislative Council as we speak being drafted. I had hoped that Claudia Black would be here. She has a copy of the amendments that we're having drafted. I'm sorry, I don't have them in my hand. Yet.
That's fine. Well,
and if you can postpone action on this bill for a couple of days, we'll have the amendments. This bill has no opposition at this point. We've broadened it to cover all public employees because we think everybody faces the same issues. And we've narrowed it to only cover the ID badges because we didn't want to get crosswise with the newspapers and the media folks.
Okay, well, we'll schedule a work session then for Wednesday.
Question?
Thank you.
Senator.
How would this happen? How would an inmate get access to the prison computer somehow that had the digitized photo of a person? I mean, how do we have an example where this has happened somehow?
No, but there is this, like, with all the ID theft that's been going on, it's been raised to this whole new level, Senator, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether this is a real fear, but this is new, and the Attorney General ruled that because it's not specifically exempt from public records, it would be considered to be part of public records, so that you could theoretically request it. And so think of it more as a precautionary measure than as a reaction to something bad that's happened.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing, and we'll look for the amendments on Wednesday. You'll let David know as soon as you can.
I will.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 3068A, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2491.
Chairman.
Senator Menas. No amendments. No, sir. This is, that's correct.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2491 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Menas moves House Bill 2491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, would you please call the roll?
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Vice Chair Menas.
Aye.
Chair Corcoran.
Aye.
House Bill 2491, having received votes, will go to the floor with a due pass. I can carry it, I guess. Anybody have any particular interest in carrying it?
Senator Starr does.
Sure.
Senator Walker's sick today. He can pick up a lot of extra.
Well, she had like six bills on the floor today, and I had one.
I think taking advantage of a sick person is kind of sick itself, but that's your own call. I mean, you know, it's an ethical decision that you'll have to live with for the rest of your life.
If the chair to sign the bills.
Okay, Senator Starr will carry the bill. Ethics schmethics. Okay, who do we have here, and what do we need to move? Let's have our discussion. We have legislative counsel here, so let's have our discussion on. We'll have a work session on Senate Bill 7, please. And so, could both of you come up, please? And you had some information you were going to share with us. A letter, okay. Right. And it's Katie.
Katie Cannon.
And the guy that's more famous than Nike, Chuck Taylor. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor, for coming. We asked Mr. Taylor to address some of the concerns that Senator Menas raised about liability, and also Katie has provided a letter from DAS regarding Senate Bill 7. So I wanted to have a little bit of a discussion with Senator Menas to see what his comfort level is. Given that we don't have Senator Walker here today, he becomes very critical because he would be the third vote. So I'd like you to address the questions that Senator Menas raised around what kind of liability the state would be accepting if the Fair Commission was allowing work to be done at the fairgrounds. Is that a correct assessment of what you were looking at?
Well, yeah, I think the question was whether or not the state was indemnifying these individuals under the circumstance, and it appears from the letter in DAS here that they have no intention of indemnifying them, but it's really not clear as to whether they are or they are not. So,
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. If you get outside of a traditional agency relationship, in other words, the affair is not exercising direction and control over the work that's being done, and the work is not being done specifically on behalf of the fair, you kind of get into an open question of law. There's been some suggestion that if you have volunteers that are providing services to a state agency and the state is benefiting from that, and it's something that the state has in fact requested, they aren't coming up with this on their own. There's been some suggestion that even though you don't have all the elements of a traditional agency there, that there could nonetheless be some extension of immunity under the Tort Claim Act. And having said that, or suggested that at least several times, the courts have routinely shied away from actually ruling that that's the case, and have always relied on a finding that there in fact was some kind of traditional agency involved where there was sufficient direction and control over the work. So I know that's not giving you a very definite answer.
Well, maybe play out a scenario for us, Mr. Taylor. If there's a horseman's organization in the state that wants mm-hmm. to assist the state fair with the construction of a horse arena, and they basically have among their group some general contractors who have construction experience, and they want to do this basically, you know, do the construction on their own, and they enter into a relationship with the fair. How would that play out in terms of that kind of responsibility? Or how might it play out?
Chair Corcoran, a lot of it depends, I think, on how the state fair would set up the situation. If they had the right to oversee the work, even if they don't actually do it, then you have direction and control over the work. If they are simply kind of sitting back and being the beneficiaries of the work with the right to say, yeah, this final product is acceptable or not, then clearly there isn't an agency relationship. There's an independent relationship there.
So if that horse group came to Ms. Cannon and said, we'd like to show your commission what we proposed, and Ms. Cannon says, okay, you put it out in the, pardon the pun, the South 40, and you put it in this particular spot at the state fair, and that's your spot, and we've seen your plans, and they look fine, go for it. And they don't have anything more to do with it during the construction phase. Does that meet the agency criteria?
Chair Corcoran, again, I think it's a matter of whether they have the right to go out there and oversee things and direct it. Not necessarily whether they actually do it in any meaningful sense, but as long as they have the right to go out there and oversee it, or on the other hand, there wouldn't be that control if they are simply by contract saying we will approve or disapprove the final product.
Ms. Cannon, Senator Menace, either one of you want to chime in here?
You know, I guess I'm satisfied that the assumption we're making in the bill is we're not extending the state's tort claim limit to volunteers and nonprofits, but I think Mr. Taylor suggests that there may be some subject litigation that might eventually or could bring the person under, depending on the level of direction and control. And, you know, I guess I'm satisfied that we ought to just go ahead and move the bill along at this point, because there are probably good things in saying expressly what we And then there's some people that are not sanctioned, too. So.
To paraphrase Senator Menace moves the bill unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hang on a second. Did we not have amendments to this that took out?
Oh, we do have dash amendments. I'm sorry, I didn't see them.
The Labor Commissioner might go berserk on you, I think.
Ah, we do not want to get in trouble with those people. They're elected.
So, Mr. Chairman, okay. if we've not done so already, I'll move.
We do not have dash. All right. Senator Menace moves dash two amendments to Senate Bill 7. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I would now move Senate Bill 7 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 7 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator.
I want to thank Ms. Cannon for her indulgence facilitating the discussion.
And thank you, Mr. Taylor, too, for coming. Appreciate both of you. And will staff please call the roll?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnick?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Senate Bill 7 is amended to the floor, and we will let either Senator Winters or Senator Courtney carry. Senator Courtney's incompetent and incapable of doing anything on his own, so we'll have to get him some assistance. So, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7, or the work session on Senate Bill 7. Let's open public hearings on our House Bill 2190 and that's the one we've got before us. All right, House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2190. What does that do, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us House Bill 2190, which grants the Employment Department explicit authority to determine questions of general policy for and adopt rules in behalf of enforcing and administering certain statutes relating to child care.
Okay, and we have an expert from the Employment Division, a non-practicing attorney by the name of Tamara Brickman. Ms. Brickman, would you please come up here?
A non-practicing attorney?
Ms. Brickman, the first goal that I have for you is you're going to explain to me how a bill can get 42 yeas, one nay, and have 15 people excused. Was it that boring a bill, or what was going on there?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, it was probably just something everybody felt very comfortable with, and I don't have any idea why there was one opposing vote.
It's not a very good explanation, but carry on, please.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And I'm here today to talk to you real quickly about a bill that is fairly technical in nature that gives the director of the Employment Department explicit authority, rulemaking authority for the Child Care Division. The Child Care Division is housed within the Employment Department up until 1993. The Employment Department existed as a division of the Department of then Human Resources, as well as the Child Care Division. Both divisions were pulled out of the Department of Human Resources in a bill in 1993. The Employment Division was made a department, and the Child Care Division was placed within the Employment Department. But when they did that, they made two separate chapters of law. And the basic Employment Department chapter of law says the director has authority for rulemaking under this chapter, which is 657, and they didn't mention 657A, which is we're just seeking to provide explicit authority for the director.
So this isn't the bill. It was 2191 that the education folks discovered a problem with, so this one had clear sailing, no opposition.
Chair Corcoran, correct.
Okay. Questions? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2190. You guys okay with this?
Mr. Chairman, just one quick question. Have you guys drafted rules that are the Legislative Council has deemed to be inappropriate?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, we have not drafted rules that Legislative Council has not approved, but when they did our three-year rule review, they suggested that we make it explicit within the stat in our chapter of law to provide the director with rulemaking authority. There is rulemaking authority within the Child Care Division statutes. The suggestion was that rather than holding a division administrator responsible, the agency head should be responsible for approving the rules, and that's why legislative counsel and our attorney general recommended this.
All right.
Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2190.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
Move House Bill 2190 to the floor of the Senate. The due pass recommendation and include it in our consent calendar.
Senator Menace moves House Bill 2190 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be considered on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace.
Aye.
Chair Corbin.
Aye. House Bill 2190 goes to the floor with the due pass since it's housekeeping, I'll carry it. And I want to commend Ms. Brickman for her excellent testimony. Had she done a bad job, I would have unleashed a series of personal questions that some of her staff and friends had gathered for me, but she escapes that this time. She doesn't seem duly impressed. Maybe we should call her back up here again. Okay, we're moving right along. Open a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3050. Can you tell us what that does, Mr. Ellsworth?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 3050 is a revenue bill. It modifies local government budget documentation requirements and procedures.
Thank you. We have Linda Burglehaus, please. Welcome.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Burglehaus. I am the director of the Tax Supervising Conservation Commission in Multnomah County. I'm here representing the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association as a board member. OMFOA is a statewide organization of financial people who work in the financial area of local governments. And before each legislative session, we come together and say, are there areas of local budget law that we would like to see brought forth for changes? The last OMFOA-sponsored bill was in 97 when we did major local budget law rewrite, and then in 99 we made some minor changes to that. And this time we came together as an organization with representatives from cities and county, the Department of Revenue, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and Special Districts Association. And the results of that meeting are what you have before you in House Bill 3050. This basically is making some changes to try to improve local budget law, to encourage more public participation in the budget processes. That was our original goal. The first three sections deal with this. We would like to make some information more relevant to the public. Under current law, there is what's called a master salary schedule included within the budget document, and it's a listing buried in there that includes salary ranges, numbers of employees within that range. We would like to see that changed by eliminating that, but within the information that's actually published in the newspaper, have total FTE, full-time equivalents, for the current budget and the upcoming budget, feeling like this is an area of interest to the public. The other information would still be available to anyone who wanted it, but this would make this publication requirement. The second thing we looked at in Section 4, we're trying to find a way to make the publication that we do in the newspapers a little more user-friendly, and so we are looking at wanting to change the format of that, that have a complete summary of the budget by classification, but also include with that or replace some other information with a listing of every fund within the budget, current year, upcoming, so that again it would be someplace that they could, hopefully the public would look at that and be able to see more easily and a concise picture of what was going on within that budget. Section 5 is a policy change. This is the only policy change that we have within this bill. And under current law, districts that have are on an accrual or full accrual basis, it's after the fact that when they sometimes find what was spent at the end. And there's two types of situations that we want to deal with here. The first one is when money is coming from another government, and the example we've given is a county is providing services to the citizens. Federal government reimburses them totally for those the costs that are involved. And oftentimes, at come the end of the year, they will have served more people than they had anticipated. And a lot of that comes sometimes in that last month of June when there isn't time. They haven't even often realized this has happened. The federal government will totally reimburse them for all their costs. That's not the problem. But when the auditors come in, they've overspent their appropriations. And they get a violation, and it makes them really look like they are not budgeting well, when in essence they really are serving their people probably better. So what we'd like to suggest is that a resolution be able to be passed or an ordinance that would make a retroactive fix that would allow them to avoid that audit violation only in that situation. One other area that we've found that that same type of situation comes in that they will receive an audit violation is capital expenditures. The Port of Portland a couple of years ago in June, the weather was incredibly good. We didn't have rain. And so at the airport, they're just going gangbusters on their construction out there. July rolls around and they find out how much they've spent. They've overspent their appropriations for capital, and they had a huge, in the millions of dollars, that audit violation. So anyone looking at that audit, it makes them look like they were doing a very poor job when, in essence, they were really probably doing a good job for the taxpayers. So for those two specific instances only, we do not want this to be a blanket where they can go in and fix things when they really have done a poor job. But in those, when there's governmental money that's being reimbursed, and in a capital expenditure situation, be able to make that a retroactive fix. Section 6 of this bill, we have five-year loans. All this does is to attempt to try to clarify and make it more clear how to show that in the budget. This has been there for a while, but there's a lot of confusion of what the budget should look like when this situation has occurred. Also, in these, they on interfund loan, they do pay interest, but what districts found was there was not the provision to make the appropriation to pay the interest at the time you pass the resolution. And this is saying, let's make that interest payment part of that resolution. You've got your appropriation authority, because they would make the resolution to do the interfund loan and then turn around and have to do a supplemental budget oftentimes to pay the interest. Section 7 and 8 deal with my office in Multnomah County. We want to add some clarifying language to the jurisdiction. We were missed when Measure 50 went in, and so that's just some clarifying language. It does not change any districts that are under our jurisdiction. Doesn't add to or delete from. And then the second thing, right now in Multnomah County, districts are required to file their budget with my office 15 days after they adopt. And we'd like to make that standard July 15th is when they file with everything else, the assessor's office and the others. And we'd like to make that, just standardize that date and make it easier for the districts. Section 9 is a Multnomah County fix also. Currently, all budgets in Multnomah County are filed in my office. We're the repository. We have 25 years of budgets and audits, and the taxpayers know this is where they come. And so we have an agreement with Multnomah County that we're the repository. The statute calls for it to be the county clerk. And so we'd like to codify this agreement we have, because it looks like if you read the law, they should be going one place, and under our agreement, they come another. And then the last piece of this actually didn't come when we did a committee. This was an add-on from the Department of Revenue. They have discovered an inadvertent error in the drafting of budgeting for debt service levies, and it basically that they cannot put an unappropriated ending fund balance in if it exceeds a P&I, and it could really cause some problems for districts if we don't get that corrected. So it doesn't change practice in any way. It just legalizes what we have been and always have been doing.
Ms. Berglehaus, do the members of the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association hang out with like pension lawyers and actuaries for a good time? Or do you guys have a good time all on your own?
I think we have a good time all on our own. Okay, good.
I just checked. Here, let me
administer. You're the chair, right?
That's right.
I just have a question where the deleted language on line 23, where you talked about salary levels, and if I understood correctly, they're going to put a total FTE in a particular range. But it troubles me that we're deleting language that says estimates of expenditures for personal services, because that seems to be a category that's outside of the wage categories. And
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, this would be in the grab that bill, and that was on which?
On 23,
the first page, one, line 23.
Okay, and what that is that's a change in the formatting on that publication.
Right.
And what it will, there still will be the total summary, which is currently called an LB1, that has all of that information rolled up as a total budget. This is the detail piece for each fund was also published.
Right.
And I
think I understand what you're doing here, but as it relates to personal service contracts, and this kind of thing, is these are outside of general employment, are they not?
This would be, but for this definition, personal services would be everything that related to wages, and it would be a one line, one number. Well, it would not be personal contracts.
I understand that, because it says estimates, this is apparently current law, estimates of expenditures for personal services, comma, other than services of persons who receive an hourly wage. So it's talking about something different than people who get an hourly wage. It's talking about personal service contracts, it seems like. The last thing I'd want to do is have the city of Portland bury, you know, $10,000 and $20,000 personal service contracts in an aggregate number somewhere.
Senator Corcoran, Senator Minnis, if it was a personal service contract outside of an employee, that would be under materials and services. It would not fall under this category into the budget. They would be classified, any contracts that you would have with others for work done other than your employees would be reported as materials and services, and that would be...
Yeah, help me understand. I mean, the sentence says, estimates of expenditures for personal services other than services of persons who receive an hourly wage. So isn't that something different than people who receive an hourly wage? Am I not getting it?
Senator Corcoran, Senator Minnis, this is, you're right, and I could give you, I have some examples if you want to see what these are currently looking like. What they are is a classification range, and what you're going to see will have five employees between the range of $10,000 and $30,000.
Right.
And a total.
I'm more interested in whether or not a municipality or a local government might use a number of personal service contracts of individuals who are not employees. Is that shown in a different category? You mentioned something that sounds like
yes.
It's buried in an aggregate number somewhere.
Senator Corcoran, Senator Minnis, that would be any contracts that you would have would be reported under materials and services. They would never be shown under personal services in the way that...
Get it out as a personal contract?
It will be as a line item within, but when it's reported for the publication purposes, it is a one-line materials and services. Everything that falls into that category is a one number in the publication. Within the budget document, you would have more detail. But what is?
Where do you have to go to get the budget document?
Senator Corcoran, Senator Minnis, you would have to ask the district, has it available. That is published in the newspaper, tells where and when you can see it. You can obtain a copy. And most jurisdictions now are also putting it on the web. You can find almost all of them on the web.
Hmm. Yes.
We're in work
Senator
session.
He's been a local government official. I don't know how it functions.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I highlighted the same section of the bill that Senator Minnis did. That's kind of a red flag for me as well. But I'm not certain exactly what we're trying to accomplish by eliminating those lines in the statute.
Does it save money in the advertisement or what?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, it will, it could save money. It will be replaced because you're now going to have a listing of every fund, and so that there will still be that, it will change the formatting of the publication.
Chairman?
Senator?
No, I'd kind of like to hold on to this.
Okay.
A little bit. I mean, frankly, if I, and I don't know much about this, except I think this is one of the areas that the public really goes gunny-sack on, and that's the personal service contract. I mean, if we could write some language to segregate those out and have a separate contract or a separate section for personal service contracts.
Yeah, I was thinking of it from, you know, sort of a folks who like to look at local government budgets probably would like to see classifications and salary ranges, number of FTEs, because it can give you a range of, you know, if there's cuts, for instance, to be made, you know, which departments are have what level of staffing. But people can get that information as a subsidiary to the budget that you write by simply doing a little digging.
Yeah, I think it's more a little digging.
It's not too difficult. I mean, I've done not real big cities, but Curry County, City of Springfield, having to look at that. I mean, it is get addable. Sometimes you have to get them to do a report.
Not to argue with you, but the mayor of the city of Portland didn't even realize after they concluded their budget that they were and personal service contracts with people that were supposed to have been fired. And she ordered an audit of all of their personnel, at least within the Portland Police Bureau, because they were continuing people in employment in personal service contracts even after they were supposed to have been called on.
So maybe what would satisfy you then is to have a line for that just explicitly lays out the money spent on personal service contracts?
Mm-hmm.
You think that's something we could put together with legislative council? Would that work for you guys?
Chair Corcoran, I don't see any problem. There is no requirement as such in current local budget law.
We love local mandates.
This is not a mandate. This is truth in budgeting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a mandate. Did I say mandate?
Citizens' right to know.
That's right. Okay, we will direct Mr. Ellsworth to work with you then, please, and mm-hmm. go to legislative council and try to draft something up that meets the spirit of a line item within, you said it was materials and services, so it would be a budget item within materials and services that would be for personal service contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a term of the business that is, I mean, folks would understand that, right?
Yes, Chair Corcoran, I think they would understand that.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we'll put you two together to get a work group and off we go. We'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3050. And colleagues, I wanted to tap these other bills in. And I don't know if... Can I do them all at once? Okay. So just open public hearings on... I'm opening public hearings on the following bills. House Bill 2191A, House Bill 2407B, House Bill 2417A, House Bill 2773, and House Bill 3162. And I'll close the public hearing on those bills. And we're adjourned.
Wow. Excellent work.
Good work.
Even though Mr. Delaney was here.